This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Well, good morning. You know, personal thought on that weather report? I don't believe it. Good morning, everybody. My name is Greg Wilkins. Today is Sunday, May 19th, 2024. This is the business section of the New York Times. The first article today, Biden's China tariffs are the end of an era for cheap Chinese goods. The president's move to protect strategic manufacturing sectors from low-cost competition aims to increase jobs, but consumers might not like the cost. This article is written by Jim Tankersley, and that is no relation to our Tankersley. For the first two decades of the 21st century, many consumer products on America's store shelves got less expensive. A wave of imports from China and other emerging economies helped push down the cost of video games, T-shirts, dining tables, home appliances, and more. Those imports drove some American factories out of business, and they cost more than a million workers their jobs. Discount stores and online retailers like Walmart and Amazon flourished selling low-cost goods made overseas. But voters rebelled. Stung by shuttered factories, cratered industries, and prolonged wage stagnation, Americans in the year 2016 elected a president who vowed to hit back at China on trade. 4 years later, they elected another one. In separate but overlapping efforts, former President Donald J. Trump and President Biden have sought to revive and protect American factories by making it more expensive to buy Chinese goods. They have taxed imports in legacy industries that were hollowed out over the last quarter century, like clothes and appliances, and newer ones that are struggling to grow amid global competition with China, like solar panels. Mr. Biden's decision on Tuesday to codify and escalate tariffs imposed by Mr. Trump made clear that the United States has closed out a decades-long era that embraced trade with China and prized the gains of lower-cost products over the loss of geographically concentrated manufacturing jobs. A single tariff rate embodies that closure, a 100% tax on Chinese electric vehicles, which start at less than $10,000 each, and have surged into showrooms around the world, but have struggled to crack government barriers to the U.S. market. Democrats and Republicans once joined forces to engage economically with Beijing, driven by a theory that America would benefit from outsourcing production to countries that could manufacture certain goods more cheaply, in part by paying their workers low wages. Economists knew some American workers would lose their jobs, but they said the economy would gain overall by offering consumers low-cost goods and freeing up companies to invest in higher-value industries where the United States had an innovation advantage. The parties are now competing to sever those ties. Lawmakers have taken increasingly hard lines on China's labor practices, intellectual property theft from foreign businesses, and generous subsidies for factories that produce far more than Chinese consumers can buy. It is unclear what new era of policymaking will emerge from those political incentives. Mr. Biden's brand of strategic industrial policy, Mr. Trump's retrenchment of a more self-contained domestic economy, or something else entirely. It's also not clear whether the American public, still reeling from the country's most rapid burst of inflation in 40 years, will tolerate the pains that could accompany the transition. "The old consensus has been blown apart, and a new one has not arisen," said David Autor, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology who helped lead the pioneering research into what has become known as the China shock of the early 2000s, when China's acceptance into the World Trade Organization helped wipe out manufacturing jobs across the developed world. But consumers and voters, Mr. Autor cautioned, can't have it both ways. You can make a trade-off. All the world is trade-offs. If you want to get to the point where the U.S. maintains and regains leadership in these technological areas, you're going to have to pay more. And it's not clear it'll work, he said. Despite their mutual embrace of forms of protectionism, Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump are offering voters contrasting views of how the American economy should engage with China in their rematch election. Mr. Trump wants to tear down the bridges of commerce between the world's two largest economies and dramatically restrict trade overall. He has pledged to raise tariffs on all Chinese imports by revoking the most favored nation trade status that Congress voted to bestow on China at the end of the Clinton administration and ban some Chinese goods entirely. He would impose new taxes on all imports from around the world. Mr. Trump bluntly asserts China will pay the cost of those tariffs, not consumers, though detailed economic studies contradict him. But Robert Leitziger, his former trade representative who remains an influential voice in Mr. Trump's trade decisions, told the New York Times reporters late last year that it was worth trading higher consumer prices for increased manufacturing employment. "There's a group of people who think this consumption is at the end," Mr. Leitziger said. "And my view is production is the end, and safe and happy communities are the end. You should be willing to pay a price for that." Mr. Biden rejects Mr. Trump's proposals as too broad and too costly. He wants to build a protective fortress around strategic industries like clean energy and semiconductors, using tariffs and other regulations. Mr. Biden is also showering companies in those sectors with billions in government subsidies, including a green energy technologies through the Inflation Reduction Act. Investment must be paired with trade enforcement to make sure the comeback we're seeing in communities around the country is not undercut by a flood of unfairly underpriced exports from China, Lael Brainard, who directs the White House National Economic Council, said in a speech on Thursday. "We have learned from the past. There can be no second China shock here in America." Many economists who continue to favor less restricted trade with China have criticized both candidates' plans, not simply because they risk raising prices for American shoppers. They say Mr. Trump's and Mr. Biden's policies could slow economic growth. Cutting off Chinese competition, they say, could force companies and consumers to spend money on artificially expensive domestic goods instead of on new and innovative products that would create new industries and new jobs. "We're going to hurt our productivity by massively overspending on these things," says R. Glenn Hubbard, a Columbia University economist who led the White House Council on Economic Advisers under former President George W. Bush. Some Democrats say Mr. Biden's best hope of building a lasting, successful China trade policy is by spending more, including potentially another round of subsidies for semiconductors and other high-tech manufacturing, and by going further on enforcement. Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, a career-long China and trade hawk in Congress, has pushed Mr. Biden to ban Chinese electric vehicles outright. Jennifer Harris, a former Biden aide who now leads the Economy and Society Initiative at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, has pushed the administration to couple its industrial policy spending with even stricter rules on what the recipients of that money can do with it. She wants stronger mandates for domestic automakers to shift to electric vehicles, for example, and stricter curbs on stock buybacks to force companies receiving government grants, like semiconductor manufacturers, to invest more in research and development. "This begins the much harder chapter that I think is much less attempted in the U.S. history of industrial policy," Ms. Harris said, making industry really prove it out. "Voters will sour on those efforts," she added, "if Mr. Biden's policies do not help quickly drive down prices of made-in-the-USA products. Americans want it both ways, and they're going to get grumpy when prices go up," she said. Polls show voters are already extremely grumpy about price increases, which are related to supply chain snarls and government and central bank stimulus as the world emerged from the COVID-19 recession. Inflation concerns are weighing on Mr. Biden's re-election chances. Current and former Biden aides are hopeful they will not also discredit Mr. Biden's economic policy strategy if he were to win a second term. Persistently higher prices from new tariffs could also hurt Mr. Trump's approval if he were to regain the White House. Those political questions are driving uncertainty about what the new era of China policy will ultimately settle into. Mr. Hubbard would like to see a retreat from protectionism and a re-embrace of what you might call more traditional values of trade policy, enforce global rules, invest heavily in national innovation to retain an edge, and when you do lose industries to a global rival, spend big to retrain the workers who are displaced so they can find new jobs. He concedes there is little appetite in the American electorate for such a policy. So does Ms. Harris. The idea that we're just going to run this movie again, knowing the political fallout that came from the first time around, is just complete suicide to me, she said. Mr. Autor said that, economically speaking, he would not like to return to the previous era of China trade. He's generally complimentary of Mr. Biden's industrial efforts, including his China policy, but says the president should give up on support of some sectors of the economy where China has driven costs extremely low, like solar cells. His latest research warns of the economic perils of poorly designed trade policy, but it also explains why presidents might keep pursuing it. In a recent paper written with several fellow economists, Mr. Autor found that Mr. Trump's tariff-centered approach did not succeed in bringing back many factory jobs to America. But, the economists found, the policy seemed to have won Mr. Trump and his party more votes. This next article, the high-class problem that comes with home equity. You may feel richer as you pay down your mortgage and home values go up. However, using that equity is another matter entirely. This article is written by Ron Lieber. A lot of money is tied up in people's homes. Those who need to tap it most, however, may have the hardest time doing so. Paying a mortgage is a form of forced savings. If you want to stay in your home, you have no choice but to make each payment. That money, plus the appreciation in the home's value, now equals $31.8 trillion for all households, according to the Federal Reserve, more than three times what it was in the year 2012. Saving for retirement, on the other hand, is not mandatory. As a result, some homeowners end up with a lot of home equity, but low retirement savings. Here's the problem with that situation. A retirement account is relatively easy to tap, and you can do so quickly. Home equity? Not so much. The most obvious way to get this equity is to sell your residence. But for some older homeowners, that may be out of the question. Your home may be just the way you like it because you built it that way or spent decades fixing it up. If you're attached to local doctors or a house of worship, it's difficult to cut ties and move away. Clearing out years of belongings is just a plain total pain. And an appropriate and affordable new place, no steps, minimal maintenance, well, that may simply not exist wherever you want to be. And there's the money. If you have a mortgage and will need to borrow to buy your next place, today's interest rates may be double your current one. There may be capital gains taxes on the sale as well. Then there's the matter of your heirs, if any. In a Fannie Mae survey of older Americans last year, 62% their goal was to leave their home to somebody else. If you have pride in the equity you've built, especially if you come from a historically disadvantaged group, the home is a testament to perseverance and a kind of legacy. So, next, want to refinance your mortgage and take cash out, or get a home equity loan or line of credit, and you don't mind high interest rates? Good luck, because you'll need a high enough income and credit score to qualify. That brings us to reverse mortgages. With this product, eligible people age 62 and older can extract equity in a variety of ways, say through a lump sum. Interest accrues in the background, and the balance of the reverse mortgage goes up instead of down, the way a normal mortgage would. You generally pay off the mortgage when the home is no longer your principal residence. Most people reject reverse mortgages. Lenders have rarely underwritten more than 100,000 federally insured ones in any fiscal year, and that hasn't happened since the year 2009. Why is that? Many older people remember scandals involving the products when borrowers felt misled and surviving spouses or heirs could not keep the homes. New federal protections helped clean things up. Still, reverse mortgages or something like them seem inevitable in a nation where individuals are entirely responsible for their own retirement savings. One good test for the utility is this. Do any financial advisors who pledge to act only in the best interest of their clients help members of their own family borrow in this way? Jeremy Epley is a financial planner in Owings Mills, Maryland, and he is one who does. His aunt lives in a house she owns outright. Inflation, however, has eaten away at her limited retirement income, and a reverse mortgage allows her to live better now. "I'd never heard of her going on vacation," Mr. Epley said. "She could live a little." His aunt has no children, and potential heirs have no particular expectations about an inheritance. If need be, Medicaid could pay for her long-term care. This is a crucial point, since many people don't tap into home equity because they want plenty left over to pay for a caregiver or nursing home themselves. There is, of course, entrepreneurial ingenuity at work. A fair bit of it is focused on getting people of any age to hand over some of the future gains on their home's value to a startup in exchange for cash now. Companies like HomePlace, HomeTap, Point, Unison, and Unlock are already at it. Their calculators may take your breath away when you see how big of a cut they could take in a decade. The ever-increasing financialization of the linchpins of our future, 401ks and the loans against them, the degrees that people can get ahead and the $1.6 trillion of student debt they require, is alarming. But workplace savings and the drive for higher education reflect good instincts. Save for later, better yourself. With home equity, we may have tipped too far into seeing homes as totems of a financial life well and conservatively lived. Homes are trophies, sure, but their equity is also a tool. Absent any radically improved government safety net, people without much savings are going to need it more ways to extract it. And moving on. In the same line, managing an inheritance when mom's money becomes your money. A sudden windfall while grieving can be an emotional minefield, particularly for younger adults. Experts share ways to handle it wisely. This article is written by Lisa Rabaska-Repi. Michael Hay knew his mother was financially secure, but he didn't fully know her situation until she was admitted to a hospital in August and he was granted her power of attorney. Even then, it wasn't until his mother's unexpected death about a month later that Mr. Hay understood that he and his two sisters were about to inherit a sum that would make a real difference in their lives. 9 months later, Mr. Hay, age 47, says he's still processing the shock of suddenly losing his 78-year-old mother while gaining an inheritance he wasn't prepared to receive. "I still call it mom's money, even though it's legally in my name," said Mr. Hay, who works at a tech startup and lives in Madison County, New York. Mr. Hay's reaction to his sudden wealth is not unusual. "It's a big shock, both emotionally and financially, and I don't know that anyone is ever prepared," said Catherine Kubiak-Rizzoni, founder of About Time Financial Planning in Rochester, New York. She recommends that beneficiaries not make any financial decisions for the first 6 months because they're likely to still be grieving. Research shows that more adult children may find themselves unexpectedly inheriting wealth over the next two decades. The silent generation, or people born roughly between 1928 and 1945 and its successors, the baby boomers, are expected to transfer significant wealth to members of Generation X and millennials over the next 20 years, according to The Wealth Report, a publication from Knight Frank, a London global property consultant. Federal Reserve figures show that half of all inheritances are less than $50,000. But with boomers reaching 80 and beyond, members of their family may begin to inherit more wealth. More than half millennials who are anticipating inheritance from their parents or another relative expect to gain at least $350,000, according to a survey by Allianz Credit Union in Chicago. Whether they actually receive that much, that's another question. An inheritance can feel like a gift, but it can also create stress, particularly for younger heirs. Many millennials lack the financial education to manage a large inheritance, said Catherine Fox, founder and advisor at Sunny Branch Wealth in Portland, Oregon, and they typically don't have a financial advisor to help them. I see a wide variety of preparedness levels, but an overwhelming majority are totally unprepared to inherit and, when money actually does come down, don't know what to do, said Ms. Fox, who works exclusively with inheritors between the ages of 25 and 55. In these cases, millennial heirs are essentially trading one set of stressors, not being able to save money, not being able to buy a home, and not preparing for retirement, for a new set of stressors relating to managing the money. I've seen people become paralyzed by the money they inherited and burdened of it because they want to make sure they steward it and grow it, Ms. Fox said. Inheriting significant wealth at a relatively young age can give someone an incredible advantage that few people have. But for many inheritors, there is a fear of failure and losing something that they didn't earn. Occasionally, the opposite occurs, and an early inheritance, before age 50, gives a false sense of financial security. Sometimes it can have an adverse effect where folks take their foot off the pedal in terms of their goals and ambitions, said Noah Damsky, a principal at Marina Wealth Advisors in Los Angeles. It depends on the person, he said. Some view the money as a cushion for a rainy day rather than an opportunity to buy a new Porsche and take a long vacation. The reality is that few people inherit enough money to allow them to stop working. Think of it more as a safety net and not the answer to everything, Ms. Kubiak-Rizzoni said. Mr. Hay and his wife plan to use his inheritance to achieve several goals. Some of the funds will help send their three children to college, while a portion will go to their retirement savings. The inheritance also enabled the couple, who had wanted a new home, to buy a larger one than they had planned and more seamlessly. The extra funds meant they didn't have to rely on selling their current house, Mr. Hay said. How to tackle a sum. Most inheritors use their windfall to buy or upgrade a home, set up college funds for their children, or pay off a large debt, Ms. Fox said. Any leftover money is typically saved for retirement. Ms. Fox recommends that her clients follow certain guidelines, regardless of the size of the inheritance. Spend 3 to 5% on something you really want. Hey, this is free money, so do something that makes you happy and is fun, she said. If you were close to the person who died, consider buying something that reminds you of him or her, or that you know the person would have liked for you to have. Give 3 to 5% to charity. Recognize your privilege and pay it forward, Ms. Fox said. Consider donating to a charity that would honor your loved one. Mr. Hay and his sisters donated to the Massachusetts Audubon Society because their mother was an avid birder. Think carefully about what to do with the remaining 90 to 94%. You need to focus on your greatest financial needs, Ms. Fox said, such as paying off a student loan or making a down payment on a house. It's important to take a long-term view, Ms. Fox said. For instance, if you use the bulk of the money to pay off a large debt, that will free up money to save for retirement. Whatever you spend your inheritance on could change your life decades into the future, she said. Molly Ackerman Pulliam, age 33, unexpectedly inherited $74,000 after her father died of cancer several years ago. She and her husband were expecting their first child, so she used some of the funds to pay off her student loan. Ms. Ackerman Pulliam said her father had always supported her education, so she believed he would advise her to follow that course. What an incredible turn of events to be able to do that, to be free and clear and not have the burden, but for such a sad reason, said Ms. Ackerman Pulliam, who lives in Fresno County, California. She also used some of the money for a large down payment on a new Subaru Forester, which replaced a car that had been her father's. Ms. Ackerman Pulliam's advice to other young inheritors? If there's a big financial obligation, take care of it. Veering off track. Beneficiaries might start out with good intentions, but then go astray. Chris Diodato warns against what he calls sudden money syndrome. Many people have not seen this amount of money or assets under their name until this moment, said Mr. Diodato, founder of Wealth, W-E-L-L-T-H, Wealth Financial Planning in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. For some heirs, seeing six figures in their bank account can be overwhelming. Suddenly, you realize in addition to your salary, you have $500,000 in the bank, he said. Without a plan for how to invest, save, and spend the money, it often just disappears over time, Mr. Diodato said. He worked with a client who received a life insurance settlement unexpectedly. When they first met, the client was an unemployed millennial who said over and over, I need to find a job right away. He talked about using the money to pay off some debt, save up for a house, maybe take a vacation, and then put the rest in a retirement account. As time passed, though, the client's desire to find work became less urgent because his inheritance provided enough money to pay all of his expenses, and in less than a year, he had spent about 30% of his inheritance. If he doesn't make a change soon, he could easily spend all of his money in about 4 years, Mr. Diodato said. Sometimes it takes seeing the account value drop from six figures to five figures for the client to get serious about financial planning, he said. Another of Mr. Diodato's clients inherited a little over $100,000. Initially, the plan was to save for retirement, but the client started using the money to travel. After spending down about $15,000 of the total, the client reached out to develop a structure for saving, investing, and spending the money. Since then, the inheritance has grown instead of shrinking. An inheritance is not a silver bullet, Ms. Kubiak-Razone said. It's a tool, and it can be a key to unlocking more possibilities. It's 28 minutes past the hour, and you are listening to WRRS, the radio reading services for the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is Greg Wilkins, and I am reading from the Sunday edition of the New York Times business section, and today is Sunday, May 19th, 2024. Along a similar line for saving money and houses, this next article is titled Renting Forever and Trying to Create a Strong Financial Future. Either by choice or because they're priced out of the market, many people plan to never stop renting. Building wealth without home equity requires a different mindset. This article is written by Paulette Perhotch. Moving back and forth from Tennessee to Alaska, Michael Rogers and his wife Christy have twice been stuck simultaneously paying a mortgage and rent. Once, in the year 2006, the situation dragged on for 8 months, finally ending when they sold their house in Tennessee for $20,000 below what they'd paid for it. Other adventures in homeownership ended well. The couple doubled their money after selling a fixer-upper. Then, later, with another property, they had to pay out $30,000 to fix a mudslide around their home, a mistake caused by the builder. 2 years ago, the Rogers moved to Kingsport in northeastern Tennessee, where they signed a lease on an apartment they thought would be a year-long stopgap before buying again. The couple just renewed their lease for a third year and has decided to remain renters for good. Mr. Rogers, a construction manager, likes the convenience of being able to move when a job calls. Either by choice or being priced out of the market, many people have decided that renting forever is their best or only option. Housing costs and interest rates have risen in the last few years, and it can make financial sense to rent. The Times has recently updated its popular rent versus buy calculator to help people understand the trade-offs. In the 1960s, the median house price was a little over twice as much as the average income. It's now nearly six times as much. Homeownership is a traditional strategy for long-term wealth building. For people who aren't planning to buy, creating a strong financial plan without building home equity requires a different mindset. Owning a home isn't a magic bullet to secure retirement. Mr. Rogers has seen how being house poor has affected older family members, one of whom has three-quarters of her net worth tied up in her house. That situation leaves people with the option of borrowing against the equity in their home or selling the home to get the value within it. He's focused on investing instead, preferring the liquidity and stability of the stock market. If you're buying something like a broad-based U.S. stock index, you're just kind of buying a slice of the entire U.S. economy, Mr. Rogers said. When you buy a house, your risk is concentrated literally down to one house in one neighborhood in one state. Mr. Rogers has found that people tend to focus on home equity over other factors. He thinks that can be a mistake. In the current market, particularly in my area, rent looks like an absolute bargain compared to what houses are selling for now, he said. That allows me to really bump up my savings rate. People are like, well, yeah, but you're not building equity. Yeah, but I've got a 35% savings rate. I'm building investment accounts much faster than I would ever build equity in the house. Choosing to rent. As in any other market, predicting the future of rent charges is impossible. Rents could deflate as they did during the pandemic in New York City, or balloon as they have in an Amazon-inflated Seattle. Housing prices could crumble as they did during the Great Recession, or explode as they have in San Francisco. The key is to have a plan that covers you in a variety of scenarios. Renting can be a better financial decision. Owning can be a better financial decision, said Ramit Sethi, author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Too often, we simply buy because our parents told us to, and their parents told them to. Though he's a millionaire, Mr. Sethi has rented for the last 20 years in cities like San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles. When he lived in Manhattan, he calculated it would have cost him 2.2 times more per month to own than rent. He emphasizes that your calculations have to include the phantom costs of mortgage interest, taxes, and maintenance, which is often estimated at 1 to 3% of a home's value. So, he rented and focused on investing. He's a fan of index funds, target date funds, and a long-term, low-cost investment. If you choose to rent, there's one key thing that's the most important thing of all, which is you absolutely must run your numbers, he said. And if it's cheaper to rent than to buy, you must invest the difference. He also negotiates his rent, which he said many people aren't aware is an option. He recommends that renters pay attention to comparable housing costs in their area. If they can find better deals, they should go in at renewal time with documentation. It doesn't always work, he said. But when it does, it's a huge benefit. Over the last century, the Standard & Poor's 500 has returned an average of about 7% a year when adjusted for inflation. Mr. Sethi said most people have no idea what the stock market is returning. But you need to know that number, he said, because it tells you what your opportunity cost is. In other words, how much you could be making if you just put your money in the market. Planning your finances while renting also has an emotional element. Mr. Sethi said people shouldn't feel guilty if they're renting. Remember, there are literally millions of people in America who rent and invest the difference, he said. You're not some weirdo just because you're choosing to rent. I do it, and plenty of other people do it. Running the numbers. I'm constantly asked why I'm not buying a house, said Miranda Marquette, who is in her mid-40s and living in Idaho Falls, Idaho. People think it's weird, she said. Ms. Marquette earns between $10,000 and $12,000 each month and has been creating an investment portfolio for the last 25 years and multiple income streams for the last 15. If you want to start planning a successful financial life without home ownership, she suggested starting with retirement calculators at investor.gov. When deciding how much I'm going to invest each month, I take a very conservative approach and assume a 6% rate of return, she said. I know a lot of people will say you should assume a much higher rate of return, especially if you're investing in stocks, but I like to err on the side of caution. You'll need to factor in how much rent is likely to increase over time. Ms. Marquette uses a 3% inflation-based estimate to come up with the number of how much you're going to need in retirement. Figuring out whether you're set for retirement is about running the numbers, whether you rent, have a mortgage, or are building a rental empire, she said. Look at what you want to do in retirement and estimate your monthly needs. Then figure out how you'll meet those monthly needs. The renting-only strategy. This is very much my life, said Berna Anat, who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. I don't see any homeowning in my future. When someone says she's throwing money away on renting, she thinks of friends who have homes. They're like, oh, we can't go on a vacation for 2 years because termites have eaten the foundation of our bathroom. Or like, yeah, we actually can't hang out this weekend because we're on our hands and knees tiling the grout of our decrepit sunroom. Forever renting is very much a movement. It's a lifestyle, she said. It comes with a cost. The theoretical equity many plan as a stronghold of their retirement. Ms. Anat, author of Money Out Loud, said replacing that home equity and living a renting lifestyle is about diversification and maximizing investments. If you're employed full-time, she said, you'll want to be fully invested in your 401k and getting as much of his employer match as possible. Ms. Anat recommends opening up another fund as well, such as a Roth IRA. The idea is if you're not spending on housing costs, closing costs, escrow, property taxes, and the like, and charges like homeowners association fees, she said, then you're investing all of that money so your retirement is as cushy as possible, since you don't have that equity. For me, as a forever renter, I have all those things, and I'm investing as aggressively as possible, she said. In the short term, Ms. Anat said you should need a plan for real-world volatility. Your rent could spike, or your building could get sold. She recommends an emergency fund of at least 6 months and a spreadsheet detailing your plan if you lose housing. If you were to have to move out of your apartment tomorrow, what's the actual plan for your funds and your life? She said. It's almost like those earthquake escape plan situations. Another consideration is your credit score. Keep it clean. Make your payments on time and try to keep the amount you owe low compared to your limit. The usual advice is to restrict your borrowing to 30% of your credit limit. Ms. Anat tries to stick to 10 to 15%. Maintaining a strong credit score is critical, she said, because landlords are looking at that, and you're more likely to have to shop the market again next month or next year and impress a landlord. You also need to protect yourself by understanding landlords' rights versus renters' rights where you live, as it varies by city and state. Buy renters' insurance, which is usually affordable. Overall, she said, you have to stabilize your life with as much financial backup as possible. It reminds me so much of being self-employed, said Ms. Anat. Being self-employed means you have to make your own plan for health insurance. You have to DIY your plan for retirement. It's a little bit more of getting into that mental mode. And the iPad is arguing with me again. Here we go. The night that Sotheby's was CryptoPunk. The auction that was supposed to be an art world coming out party for NFTs instead exposed the instability at the heart of the crypto world. This article is written by Zachary Small. It would have been the greatest insult to rock the Upper East Side on any normal night, but instead, the private equity heir, Holly Peterson, could only laugh. Why had a Sotheby's official denied her access to a bidding paddle? In February 2022, Ms. Peterson, an author and art collector, was surrounded by a new clientele, the crypto nouveau riche, who made a temporary home of the art market. Their purchases occurred through the trendy innovation of NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, which registered the ownership of often digital artworks on the blockchain. Collectors then used the NFTs as rapidly appreciating investments to build their crypto fortunes. The young collectors arrived in sweatpants and greeted one another by their Twitter handles. It was supposed to be another banner evening for the booming art market, where NFTs had come to represent almost half the industry's $65 billion valuation in only a couple of years. The marquee lot included 104 CryptoPunks, a selection of algorithmically generated portraits of pixelated people that epitomized the rise of blockchain-based collectibles. They were estimated to sell for $20 million to $30 million, and, for the first time, Sotheby's had devoted a major sale to just a single lot of NFTs. It was a rare honor, one that hadn't even occurred when the auction houses had a $450 million Leonardo da Vinci on their hands. The night received all the marketing gusto that a company serving billionaires and their baubles could muster. Sotheby's had described the event called Punk It on as par with the most significant and high-profile sales for contemporary and modern art. But there were early signs that the NFT market was crashing, a spectacular implosion that would shine a spotlight on the government's failure to regulate the art market. Ms. Peterson was one of many traditional collectors who had attended the auction to purchase their first NFT. Her father was Peter G. Peterson, the private equity billionaire who founded Blackstone and served as a Museum of Modern Art trustee. She was a trustee at the Studio Museum in Harlem and on several acquisition committees for organizations like the Whitney Museum of American Art, the Brooklyn Museum, and Centre Pompidou. But none of the pedigrees could prepare her for the bizarre scene at Sotheby's. Miss Peterson looked around and saw these new collectors who reminded her of little toddlers with paddles, she recalled in an interview. "What's going on?" she said. "I'm a Park Avenue woman with a fancy art collection, and I couldn't even get a paddle." Buyers could pay in cryptocurrencies or regular dollars. A panel that preceded the sale included Kenny Schlachter, a rabble-rousing collector and columnist at ArtNet News, who, from his brownstone on the Upper East Side, had situated himself as a communicator between the crypto and traditional art worlds. Also, he had his own NFT project to promote. A bulldog for the digital art movement, he managed to corner Max Hollein, the Met Museum director, one evening in Central Park, recalling that the museum executive said that his curators were too scared of the new technology to partake. Speaking to the VIP attendees at the Sotheby's auction, Mr. Schlachter waxed poetic about the promises of NFTs, saying they had changed the history of art without even intending to be an art piece in the first place. An audience that included celebrity influencers like the rapper Ja Rule and Snoop Dogg's son Cordell Broadus clapped. Behind the scenes, employees were scrambling to salvage what was supposed to be a historic sale. According to three people close to the sale, there had been signs of trouble from the beginning of the auction house's relationship with the seller, who operated behind the username 0x650D. There was virtually no public information about him. His digital identity was created to promote his CryptoPunk collection, which he purchased in 2011 for around $7 million, saying that he acquired the NFTs because I choose wealth. But he also said he would never sell them, which should have been Sotheby's first warning sign. Sotheby's had been the collector's second choice to sell his CryptoPunks after he initially failed to secure a deal at Christie's. And, unlike the traditional collectors who attended the auction ready to buy the newfangled art, there was a lack of enthusiasm from crypto collectors. These NFTs were known as floorpunks, meaning they lacked certain attributes that gave other CryptoPunks their higher market prices. The algorithm that generated the entire collection of 10,000 images had statistical rarities baked into the code. For example, there were only 9 punks dressed as aliens and 24 that looked like apes. In March 2024, someone reportedly purchased an alien punk for $16 million. But 0x650D's collection contained only basic, run-of-the-mill examples of the NFT originally created by Larva Labs, a studio run by the Canadian software developers Matt Hall and John Watkinson. So there was little incentive for a serious NFT collector to buy this suit of tokens, especially at a time when purchasing a single CryptoPunk at floor price would have cost about $150,000. A simple calculation would have made clear that at $30 million, Michael Bohanna, a digital art specialist at Sotheby's, had overpromised on the total value of the lot by nearly double the high estimate of what a retail trader could find online, where a group of CryptoPunks this size would have gone for around $15 million. And then there was the matter of poor timing. Cryptocurrencies had just taken a nosedive with news that Russia had invaded Ukraine, risky assets looking less enticing with the interest rates rising. There was still an appetite for speculation, but perhaps not as much when everyone's wallets had suddenly depreciated in value. Risk needed some promise of reward. NFTs were a symptom of the unregulated art market. The NFT boom coincided with the art market's growing reputation as a Wild West where paintings by artists like Marc Chagall and René Magritte turned into vehicles for sanctions evasion, money laundering, and fraud disguised by shell companies. In the year 2020, for example, Senate investigators found that auction houses and dealers had allowed two sanctioned Russian oligarchs, their brothers Arkady and Boris Rotenberg, to buy and sell art using shell companies fronted by an art advisor. Their report concluded that brokers went through with the sale despite a failure to determine the true identities of their clients. Despite that congressional scrutiny, a new era of deregulation was approaching, happening just in time for NFTs to thoroughly scramble the relationship between artistic merit and financial value. The auction at Sotheby's took place just weeks after the federal government had shied away from enforcing the Bank Secrecy Act on the art industry, which would have increased the scrutiny of financial transactions and ended the use of shell companies to conceal the true identities of buyers and sellers. When Congress commissioned a report in the year 2021 to address concerns that the art market had become a safe haven for a number of financial crimes, the responsibility fell upon the Treasury Department and its aptly named Deputy Assistant Treasury for Strategic Policy, Scott Rembrandt, who is no relation to the old Dutch master of the same name, who was unfamiliar with the financial esoterica of the art world. Dealers were prepared for the worst after regulators in the European Union and Britain banned straw purchases, that is, the practice of buying something on behalf of a secret purchaser, and other schemes that cloaked the true parties behind a painting sale. Anxiety rolled into the next year as the New York Attorney General's office accused Sotheby's of an alleged tax fraud scheme in which more than a dozen clients obtained false resale certificates to pose as dealers and avoid paying millions in tax revenue on their purchases. A judge allowed the investigation to proceed, saying there was enough evidence that senior members of the auction house willfully turned a blind eye to the scheme. Tight-lipped dealers were not afraid of making noise when their profits were threatened. Galleries and auction houses spent nearly $1 million over the past 2 years on lobbying federal officials in Washington on regulatory issues. When the Treasury Department released its highly anticipated report in February of 2022, it did not recommend immediate government intervention, despite clear evidence of criminal activity. We have found that while certain aspects of the high-value art market are vulnerable to money laundering, it's often the case that there are larger underlying issues at play, like the abuse of shell companies or the participation of complicit professionals, who might look the other way, Mr. Rembrandt said in an interview, implying that art crime was more of a byproduct of a flawed financial system than a characteristic of the industry. But the Treasury official had relied on bad statistics. Mr. Rembrandt said that only $3 billion in money laundering and other financial crimes flowed through the art market every year. That was an errant number, which could be traced back to an unattributed claim from a 1990 article in The Independent by the British journalist Geraldine Norman about the antiquities market. The Treasury Department did not respond for a request to comment. The lack of original research in the Treasury report demonstrated the government's failure to deeply scrutinize the art market. NFTs were, in some ways, a result of that oversight. They were more easily abused as vehicles for fraud than other kinds of art by virtue of their digital existence. Sales happen within seconds and without nosy customs officials or know-your-customer practices to impede criminals. And although Mr. Rembrandt was unwilling to bring federal oversight to the art market, he specifically called out the rising danger of NFTs in his report, warning, "These type of contracts can create an incentive to shape a marketplace where the world where the work is traded repeatedly in a short period," adding, "Traditional industry participants, such as art auction houses or galleries, may not have the technical understanding of distributed ledger technology required to practice effective customer identification and verification in this space." What happened only a few weeks later at Sotheby's would illustrate the problems that Mr. Rembrandt raised and highlight the Treasury's failure to establish new oversight regulations on the art market that would have required the auctioneer to perform more due diligence of its clients. A rug pull to remember. Back in the sales room, the audience eagerly looked toward an empty podium where the auctioneer should have started the bidding nearly half an hour ago. Instead, officials announced the consigner had withdrawn the lot. Everyone was still welcome to enjoy the after-party and listen to the sick beats of DJ Steed Phrase. Stunned, the young crypto investors sipped their last drops of champagne and exited out the auction house's revolving doors onto York Avenue. It looked like 0x650D had sized up the money he stood to make at an auction and decided it was unlikely to add to the number he was looking for. "That whole evening was totally surreal," said Ms. Peterson. "The auction definitely made me think something was rotten." For market rainmakers like Amy Capolazzo, a former Sotheby's executive, the event was even more significant. "It was an early sign the crypto market was in trouble," she said. NFT collectors need strong sales to continue their momentum. But catastrophes like the Sotheby's auction broadcast that the NFT industry's best days were behind it. Traditional collectors like Ms. Peterson, who might have joined the digital art collectathon, were now backing away while skeptics celebrated proof of the blockchain's impotence. "Collectors from the old economy are afraid that their marketplace will be disrupted by these crazy, wacky forces," Ms. Capolazzo said. "There's nothing more tried and true than owning a hard asset like a painting and putting it on the wall. But anything that softens a hard asset will make them feel uneasy." The anonymous consigner, 0x650D, tried to salvage his online reputation. He posted on Twitter at 7:41 p.m., nearly an hour after pulling the lot, to announce his decision to HODL, H-O-D-L, which is crypto speak for holding on to digital assets. About an hour later, he shared a meme that featured the musician Drake, saying he was taking punk's mainstream by rugging Sotheby's. By rugging, R-U-G-G-I-N-G, he meant rug pulling, a scheme in which crypto developers intentionally attract investors to a project only to disappear without handing over a product. Of all the crypto scams that deflated the NFT market, rug pulling was the most notorious and frequent because it transformed goodwill into a liability. There were at least four such scams that totaled more than $11 million in lost investments, including projects that imitated the Bored Ape Yacht Club, a high-profile set of NFTs. But the failed Sotheby's auction was an unusual moment in which the provocative behavior of the crypto world bled into the art market. And there was very little strategic benefit to the consignor's public marketing of the world's largest auction house. His rug pull could only be bad for the crypto reputation. In the short term, it was clear that 0x650D believed he'd made a smart move. After the auction fiasco, his accounts on social media went silent for nearly a month, until April 2022, when he announced that his CryptoPunks collection would be used as collateral for an $8.32 million loan, unlocking the liquidity of his NFTs, while allowing him to retain upside exposure through the collectibles. The loan appeared to be 40% of the low estimate that Sotheby's had given for the value of his collection, indicating that 0x650D was able to use the auction house's appraisal to legitimize the value of his NFTs. It let him keep his punks so that he could, theoretically, sell them for more than he would have made at Sotheby's, and use them as a piggy bank for liquidity in the meantime. It looked as if he'd use the art world as a mark. But 2 years later, thanks in large part to the art world's distrust of NFTs, CryptoPunks are worth far less. 0x650D appears to still hold his lot, which is now worth about $12.3 million, a significant decrease from the $20 million he turned his nose up at Sotheby's. It's about 3 minutes before the hour. I don't have any more short articles, so we'll go ahead and wrap things up. This has been Greg Wilkins reading from the New York Times business section. Today is Sunday, May 19th, 2024. And when Charlie read the weather report, like I said, I don't believe it for a minute. Just remember, you can be a weatherman and be wrong 50% of the time and still get to keep your job. Until the same bat time and bat channel, I wish you a safe, pleasant, healthy, and hopefully a comfortable air-conditioned week. So long.